105th. A middle-aged white man strolled by. "Mister," I said shyly, "care to buy a bag for 2 cents?" I held up a bag. He looked first at the bag, and then he lowered his eyes onto my bust line. His lips spread into an eerie grin. "No," he leaned in and whispered as he ogled my chest. "But I will give you 5 cents for it if you let me touch your breasts." I dropped the bags. With adrenaline surging through me, I scrambled to the ground and gathered the totes into a jumbled heap. I darted away, escaping across the street to reunite with Mr. Taylor. The man went on about his business, looking back at me over his shoulder as he walked off.
"Everything all right?"
said Mr. Taylor, who'd seen me dropping the bags. "Yes," I lied.
"Was that man bothering you?" he asked.
I shook my head from side to side as my insides screamed otherwise. At 9, I was still quite skinny. But developmentally, I was ahead of schedule. My breasts had come in early. Still, they couldn't have been any bigger than apricots. And yet on my petite frame, they appeared to be the size of peaches that this man believed were his to pick. I hadn't yet begun wearing bras, had only my shirt as a barrier between my chest and that man's animalistic gaping. As he'd undressed me with his eyes, my knees buckled, my spirit revolted. It was the first time I'd ever been approached in a sexual manner. It was the last time I felt truly safe. With his hungry gaze, this stranger had stolen from me a sense of security. That is what violation does. It wrenches away one's God-given freedom to exhale, to feel relaxed and unguarded in this world. You don't have to be physically touched to be emotionally robbed. For the rest of that morning, I stayed 2 inches from Mr. Taylor's elbow. Down the avenue and back we walked, holding up our bags as I prayed inwardly for my dear mother. I felt fearful about continuing, but I knew Mom needed our help. We stayed out on that street for 3 hours until every one of our 50 bags was sold, earning us a $1 return on Mr. Taylor's 25-cent investment. Before dusk, Mom arrived at the cart to pick us up. Mr. Taylor presented her with the dollar as he proudly told her about my brother's resourcefulness. She thanked Mr. Taylor and Melrose profusely, and we left. But instead of returning to our apartment, Mom led us to 98th Street and 3rd Avenue. We stopped at a building marked 234 East 98th. Mom led us up a rickety staircase to an apartment on the 4th floor. She pulled out a large silver key, turned it inside the lock, and pushed open the heavy wooden door. Emily, Melrose, and I darted into the 2-bedroom space, peering at our possessions scattered across the living room and wondering how they'd gotten there. Mom rested her pocketbook on the radiator and said to us, "This is our new home." True to Mom's nature, she let a decade pass before she told me all the distress that day had held for her. After leaving us with Mr. Taylor, she returned to our apartment. By then, my father had gone off someplace. Mom yanked up the bottom corner of her mattress, dug into an open slit she'd made with her sewing scissors, and fished out the wad of cash she'd been hiding there for months. She counted out $500. She then dashed to the corner store and purchased some boxes. Back in our apartment, she single-handedly packed up the few things we owned. Near the doorway, she stacked her boxes alongside her sewing machine, our beds, and the broken bureau. She did not touch my father's things. Over the next hour, she walked all over our area in search of vacancy signs. She discovered one at 234 and inquired about it.
The landlord offered Mom a price she could afford for a place that would still be within walking distance of our school. Within hours of my father's fit of rage, she'd put down a deposit on our new lives. Once she'd secured the apartment, Mom went to see Reverend Byron. "I'm leaving Willie," is all she said, her speech steady. He nodded in recognition, requiring no explanation beyond the steadfastness etched on her face. The Reverend offered her one of his moving vans, as well as some extra hands. Soon after, he and several deacons arrived at our apartment and helped my mother load up everything. As they hauled boxes, my father returned home. He stood in the doorway and gaped at the scene before him. "The children and I are leaving," my mother said plainly. "I've already found a new apartment." He did not attempt to stop her, nor did he question her choice. And particularly in the presence of Reverend Byron, whom my dad respected, he did not dare argue. He knew by Mom's sternness that nothing he could say would change her trajectory. He could sense her resolve, could feel his own fault in the matter. He gathered his belongings and packed them, and then he poked through Mom's boxes to be sure none of his effects had been inadvertently mixed in with ours. To this moment, I am in awe of how my mom made it through that day. Please don't tell me anything about black women, about our extraordinary fortitude and resilience, because I know precisely who we are. Beneath the burdensome weights of abuse and degradation, my mother straightened her spine, summoned the strength of God and her ancestors, and bravely stepped ahead. She felt as frightened as any woman would, felt her stomach climbing into her throat. But when circumstances called on her to rise, she answered with nary a quake in her voice. By jamming that lock on the bureau, my father thought he'd rendered my mother financially helpless. But never once during their relationship was he able to rupture her resourcefulness. Like so many in our world do, my father gravely underestimated a black woman's ingenuity. He hadn't counted on Mom creating a second stockpile of cash. Just as he hadn't anticipated, she'd teach the other woman a lesson amid a whirlwind of dust. And what had been true on that autumn day was undeniable on this one. My mother had had enough. That morning, Dad had unleashed an inferno that prompted Mom to move her children out of his destructive path. Without realizing it, my father had crossed a red line of demarcation, the one labeled maternal instinct. And when he blazed his way out our front door, my mother found a way to march us through a new one. That is power. That is tenacity. That is an oak. Our father showed up at the new apartment that evening. How did he know we were here, I wondered, as he casually entered. He must have seen the question in my eyes because he said, "Sis, I came to put a new lock on the door." My mother had been the one to give him our address and had even asked him to come and install our old lock on the new door. Her intent hadn't been to ban him from our lives, only to put some distance between their children and his tirades. "I wonder if he's going to stay here," I thought. "Maybe they made up." They hadn't, but they did put a peace treaty in place. Dad would be present in our world. He just wouldn't permanently reside with us. After leaving our old apartment that morning, he'd rented his own place a few streets away. As Dad unscrewed the lock, his hands shook ever so slightly. Tears welled up in his eyes and threatened to escape. He was absolutely broken. He knew he was to blame, that his womanizing had provoked the rift. In the following years, Mom would often say that the other woman had splintered our home, that she'd created so much misery for our family. But in the quietest chambers of their hearts, my mom and dad must have known the reality. That woman spotted a crack in my parents' connection, a fissure that had been forming for quite some time. She simply slid her way into a deep crevice that was already in existence. My dad had been the one most culpable for fracturing our family. On that Sunday, when we children cast our stones, we struck just one of the two Goliaths. My father, the taller and more accountable giant of the pair, initially went untouched. I lingered near my dad's side as he installed the lock. When he finished, he leaned in close to me and whispered, "I threw away all the things your mother used to beat you with." During the long months of his latest affair, Mom's tongue had dripped with more and more venom. When she called me Father Face, she did so with a sneer. Given how much I resembled my dad, as well as how much my mom detested his unfaithfulness, my dad feared I'd pay a blistering price in the coming years whenever my appearance reminded my mother of his. So when Mom's back had been turned that morning, he'd removed some wooden hangers and extension cords from her boxes. He also took her jump ropes. If I, Emily, or Melrose disobeyed our mother, she'd sometimes sit on the edge of her bed and braid three of those ropes together as she warned, "This is for you." I didn't know what to think about my father's attempt to spare me a beating. In one respect, I was relieved that Mom would have fewer weapons to use against me. But in another regard, I understood it was my dad's conduct, not my mother's belt, that had created this upheaval in our home. His comment left me feeling as if I were somehow in the middle, just as I'd been on all those nights when I'd crammed my body between theirs, begging them to surrender. And from my place at the center, I vacillated between my tremendous love for my father and my anger at his behavior. After Dad had gone, Melrose set up our pullout. Until Mom bought each of us a bed, that is where we slept. As the sun set on the most painful pivot of my childhood, I lay there quietly weeping next to Emily. Much as I knew my father's affairs were the true reason for our family's dissolution, I also felt deeply responsible. I had been the one to forget about what my father had asked me to do, had been the child who'd left his underwear sitting in that pail, soaked with water, heavy with enough proverbial kerosene to spark flames. It was my forgetfulness that had catapulted him into the fury that overturned our world. However untrue I now know that is, it is what I felt as a girl. For some, childhood innocence slips away in small increments over years with the steady tick-tock of a metronome. I lost my wide-eyed naivete in one frightful pendulum swing in the cadence of a single day. My space and spirit violated. My family irreparably broken. 5. The Other America. I saw two horror films as a child, one in a theater, another on a sidewalk in the Bronx. The first frightened the daylights out of me. The second vexed my spirit. The sanctified and the secular were not mixed in our home, so Hollywood films, as part of the latter world, were mostly absent during my upbringing. Emily, Melrose, and I did sometimes watch movies at church. In the basement, the youth leaders would string a sheet onto a wall, set up a small projector, and play films they felt were appropriate for us, like Little Rascals or any other show with black children in the cast. They wanted to instill in us a pride in our heritage. Reflecting back to us on the screen, those who shared our features, was a way to affirm us, even if the characters available to us then sometimes reinforced racial stereotypes. Little Rascals, for instance, was ahead of its time in featuring cross-cultural friendships, but the clueless Buckwheat, with his wildly spiked hair, spoke very little, and when he did, he often mumbled incoherently. Church films aside, never once had my mom taken us to see a movie in a theater. That changed in 1935, the year I turned 11. Though my mother and father had been separated for quite some time by then, they would occasionally still go at it, especially when Dad came by our apartment talking some nonsense. One Saturday during spring, Mom had heard enough and hastened my father out the door. Soon after, she blurted out a sentence that hadn't ever passed her lips. "Children, we're going to the movies," she said matter-of-factly, as if we regularly took part in that activity. My sister, brother, and I exchanged looks of disbelief and scrambled to put on our shoes. Mom needed to lay down her burdens on this afternoon, and for reasons unknown to me, she chose to lower them in the aisles of a darkened theater. We walked to the Eagle Theater, a movie house then at 102nd Street and 3rd Avenue. King Kong was playing. We settled into our seats as the lights dimmed and the curtains parted. The moment that massive gorilla pounded onto the screen, my throat closed. I eventually caught my breath, only to lose it again when Kong thrust his 8-foot hand into the apartment of the blonde starlet portrayed by Canadian actress Faye Ray. I gasped, burying my face in Mom's shoulder. As the monster snatched the lady from her bed and pulled her from the window, she flailed her arms and screamed bloody hell. And for months after that, so did I. In all of my childhood, King Kong was the only film I saw at the cinema, and Mom regretted choosing that one. At nights, I'd wake up howling from a nightmare. I didn't step foot in a theater again until the 1972 premiere of Sounder. That's how disturbing I found that beast. I seem to recall my mother putting me between her and my father in bed, attempting but failing to pacify me. But I'm not sure how that could have been because they'd already split. The year of King Kong brought with it an even more frightful drama. This one from the real-life chronicle I call Being Poor and Black. After my parents separated, Mom took on more work. By then, she'd moved on from her nanny job, but continued as a housekeeper. Between her permanent shifts, she also sought out day-long cleaning jobs. Her clients were well-to-do Jewish families. She'd come home loaded down with shoes and clothes, as well as food left over from the portions she'd made for her employers. That is how I came to enjoy matzo ball and borscht soups. Particularly with her regulars, Mom was embraced as a family member, though one, of course, not completely in the fold. Yes, she was treated with great kindness and felt strongly attached to these families. But at the end of the day, she was still the help. As long as she and others like her dared not stray outside the bounds of their status, love overflowed. Therein lies the dynamic in which black people can be seen and even welcomed by whites, but seldom genuinely known by them, rarely viewed beyond the limited, one-dimensional role we play in their narrative, a saga in which a blonde woman, not a black one, is nearly always the beauty to be saved, the damsel in distress deserving of rescue from a monster like Kong. That same year, on a Saturday morning a few weeks before Easter, Mom said to me, "Take the train to the Bronx this afternoon, and we'll go to Alexander's together." Though she'd already made my dress for our most sacred religious holiday, Mom wanted me to pick out some new shoes and a pocketbook to complete my ensemble. She scribbled down the address where I was to meet her and handed me the paper. Nomad that I am, I couldn't get myself out of our apartment fast enough. It was raining when I got off at my stop, near the busy shopping district where 3rd Avenue and East 149th Street intersect. In those days, Alexander's, one of the city's most prominent discount clothing store chains, was in a sprawling building called the Hub, which I spotted upon exiting the L. From there, I began searching for the address Mom had given me, checking the number on every building, pulling the hood of my raincoat down over my forehead to guard me from the drizzle. I finally glimpsed the street name Mom had given me. As I turned onto the block, I spotted a group of about 12 black women along the sidewalk. What are these ladies doing here, I wondered, scanning the faces and recognizing none. My mom wouldn't be here. She doesn't know these women. I paced onward. And then suddenly, just as I was walking off, I heard someone say, "Sister." I spun around, and there among the women stood my mother. I looked again at the women surrounding Mom, struggling to make sense of why they'd all be gathered there in a group. Right then, a white woman approached. She tilted back her umbrella, scanned one of the black women from head to toe, and said to her, "Can you start now?" The woman nodded and followed her. A few more white women strolled past and repeated a similar exchange. On the street, a couple of Buicks slowed down alongside us as motorists peered out their windows at Mom and the others. I took in the sight as an awareness jolted through me. These women were lined up to be considered for work, inspected as if on an auction block the way enslaved Africans once were. Who was the strongest? Whose teeth were cleanest? Who among these apes was least likely to stir up trouble? Which one was worthy of purchase? The scene was reminiscent of what black people had experienced time and again during the most shameful chapter of America's history. One by one, strangers waltzed up to survey them with a sweeping glance, hardly looking into the woman's eyes as they determined who seemed decent or tidy or docile enough to cross their thresholds and clean their homes. I obviously knew my mother worked as a domestic, but I'd grasped that fact only in concept, the way I'd theoretically understood through reading the ruthless brutality my ancestors withstood. But on that sidewalk, as onlookers stopped by to evaluate my mom, the agonizing truth of her situation settled over me. I'd never imagined that my own mother, a queen who wore her dignity as a splendorous flowing silk cape, could be in such a position. I'd never imagined that someone so majestic would have to put up her labor for sale while casting her gaze downward in deference to white strangers. That reality cut me deeply, sliced through the raw flesh of my insides. It stung me in the same way that my Italian classmate's words once had. And just as I'd done then, I shoved down the hurt, locked it behind an unmarked door in my heart, where griefs unimaginable reside. The experience was yet another discovery of how my people were viewed. It was a reminder of our true position in this nation, like a map with an enormous red dot labeled, "You are here." Black children learn where they stand in this world by recognizing the spaces where our people can and cannot enter. And if granted access, whether our presence and humanity will be regarded as equal. Earlier that day, Mom had finished her usual work shift. She'd stopped on this street, the known pickup location for housekeepers, only in hopes of booking another job for after we'd shopped. But she didn't linger on that sidewalk long enough to be chosen. She'd noticed my disbelief, seen how I'd hesitated to walk toward her after she'd called to me. There was a flicker of shame in her eyes. Her embarrassment wasn't about seeking out the kind of work she could get as a black immigrant in 1930s America. It was about my reaction. "Come on," she said, taking me by the hand and leading me from the huddle. "Alexander's is over there." "I don't want to go anymore," I mumbled. "What's the matter with you, child?" she asked. "Nothing," I said, my expression betraying my claim. "I just don't want to go." We went anyway, and as we navigated the packed store in search of my Easter accessories, I replayed in my head the scene I'd witnessed. All of these years later, I have not gotten over the horror of what happened on that street. I may never. The era I grew up in both deepened my racial wound and soothed it with the healing balm of the arts. My childhood spanned the 1920s and 1930s, two of the most economically memorable and culturally rich decades in U.S. history, a period when Negro literature, music, and culture flourished. The Roaring Twenties rollicked joyously with jazz, decadence, and illegal whiskey, while the thunderous market crash of 1929 rattled nerves throughout the 30s. What these shifts meant to daily life, or whether they had any noticeable consequence at all, depended upon where you lived and how much you were able to earn, both of which were inextricably tied to the color of your skin. The United States has never been one nation under God, but several nations gazing up at him, dissimilar faces huddled beneath a single flag. In white America, the 20s may have roared, but in my black world, in what has been called the other America, the decade also moaned. Then, when stock prices plummeted, catapulting the nation into its worst economic downturn, black people knew what we still know. Communities of color are always grappling with financial despair. The fact that the Great Depression was given a name just meant that enough whites were now suffering alongside us to warrant an official title. For the majority culture, the 20s can be summarized in two words: flamboyant excess. The First World War, then the bloodiest in human history, had at last come to an end, however unsatisfying its conclusion. Americans moved on from their sorrows by throwing a decade-long soiree. When I came along in 1924, the same year, by the way, that the famous Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade began, the wartime economy had already ushered in unprecedented financial prosperity. In short, Americans had more money than ever, and it was burning a hole in their pockets. Materialism grabbed a hold of the zeitgeist and would not stop squeezing. Though the abundance mostly benefited middle and upper class workers, it lifted the tide for all, buoying spirits and replenishing bank accounts. Wall Streeters strutted through Manhattan with extra millions in their portfolios and greater confidence in their strides. In 1920, Prohibition banned the sale and import of liquor, giving rise to bootleggers who smuggled booze across borders and into speakeasies. As the good times shimmied, hemlines rose. Young flappers, with their bobbed hair and rebellious streaks, showcased their opulence with mink stoles at lavish parties in a Great Gatsby-style existence. During the architectural boom, skyscrapers soared in Midtown, with construction commencing on the Art Deco-style Chrysler Building in 1928. Affluence was the new American goal, and for many, the extended bull market put that aspiration within reach for the first time. As spending power increased, consumers laid out cash for all manner of luxuries and appliances. Cars, Ford's Model T had its heyday, automatic washing machines, however, those as poor as we were, continued to rely on manual washboards. We never got a machine. Electric refrigerators, we also never replaced our icebox with a fridge, and phonographs and radios. The day my father brought home a small RCA set and turned it on, I thought, now why is there a voice coming out of that box? Americans also had more to spend on leisure, flocking to see the rash of both silent films and talkies released during those years. The antics of Charlie Chaplin with his mustache and baggy pants drew millions to the box office. In 1927, the first talkie, the jazz singer, lured theatergoers into enormous movie palaces, as cinemas were then called. The movie business grew into big business. New York City earned its wings during the 20s. The five boroughs overflowed with more than 5 million residents, moving the city ahead of London as the world's most populous. By boat and by rail, by foot and by any means necessary, immigrant families flooded in, carrying with them the same dreams my parents had clutched. During phase one of the Great Migration, millions of colored folks, as we were then called, moved from the rural South to New York City and other urban centers around the Northeast and Midwest. The Ku Klux Klan had raised its burning crosses with increasing height and frequency, signaling it was long past time for us to flee. Like Rebecca and Nathan in Sounder, many had worked as sharecroppers whose efforts and earnings were exploited. They escaped in search of civic and economic parity. Those who came to New York mostly settled in Harlem, then the largest black community in the nation. Uptown West was the place to be, a cultural epicenter for the United States and the Western world. The nation began tapping its toes to bebop during the jazz age. If jazz was America's first musical superstar, then Harlem was that star's grand arena. The 20s, its golden hour. The avenues and alleys vibrated with the sounds of improvisation, of trumpet and piano and syncopated rhythms seemingly delivered scattershot and yet masterfully arranged into a sophisticated whole. The nightclub scene was exactly that, a scene. Anyone eager to cut a step while relishing big band brilliance stopped by the Savoy Ballroom, birthplace of the Lindy Hop and land of the Charleston and Foxtrot, or the back room. The speakeasy's entrance was hidden behind a bookcase. The Cotton Club, then on 142nd Street and Lenox Avenue, was the ultimate hotspot. Night after night during that decade and beyond, greats such as Duke Ellington, Fletcher Henderson, Cab Calloway, Billie Holiday, Louis Armstrong, Fats Waller, Bessie Smith, and Jelly Roll Morton delivered hanky-lifting performances, riveting audiences with their artistic genius. Hits like Ain't Misbehavin' and Sweet Georgia Brown reverberated from nightclub venues and onto boulevards. Late-night jam sessions extended into the early morning hours, with revelers in zoot suits and feather boas stumbling home at daybreak. As Americans of all racial backgrounds fell under the irresistible spell of the hip new sound, jazz radically altered the musical landscape. The music's electrifying spirit could not be contained, even amid a strictly religious upbringing like my own. The city pulsated with revival, and as a child, I could feel the fervor. Exuberance danced its way up and down 125th, Harlem's bustling Main Street. Jazz stirred at the center of a broader cultural movement, the Harlem Renaissance, a profound social, intellectual, and artistic awakening in Black America that spilled over into all facets of society. Renowned philosopher Elaine Locke, who penned the movement's definitive text, The New Negro, 1925, called the era a spiritual emancipation. James Weldon Johnson had his own description for it, a flowering of Negro literature. A historically shackled and voiceless community now demanded its full freedom and its say. It was our first opportunity in this country to define ourselves, to express our unique identity, and declare our humanity. The chorus of gifted literary voices Locke gathered in The New Negro, which includes essays, poetry, and fiction by writers such as Zora Neale Hurston, Langston Hughes, County Cullen, and Claude McKay, delivered the movement's rallying cry for Black autonomy and self-respect. Locke, who earned his doctorate at Harvard University, was the first Black Rhodes Scholar and served as a philosophy professor at Howard University, encouraged artists to look to Africa for inspiration. The path to Black progress, he understood, began with self-determination and a regard for our homeland heritage. The question is no longer what whites think of the Negro, he wrote in his anthology, but of what the Negro wants to do and what price he is willing to pay to do it. Locke and his contemporary W.E.B. Du Bois, one of the most distinguished scholars of the 20th century and the author of The Souls of Black Folk, 1903, held differing views about Black aesthetic expression and its role in the movement. And yet the two shared the conviction that the arts were essential to forging a new Black identity. Du Bois founded and edited The Crisis, the flagship publication of the NAACP that gave voice to artists and intellectuals during the Harlem Renaissance and beyond. With the Black elite at its helm, the Renaissance shined its light into every corner of the artistic community, from literature and music to the performing and visual arts. Shuffle Along, which was produced, written, and performed entirely by African Americans, debuted on Broadway in 1921, showcasing the talents of Josephine Baker, Paul Robeson, and Adelaide Hall. Aaron Douglas, the eminent painter and graphic artist who produced the illustrations for The New Negro, created hundreds of images that evoked Black pride and captured the Renaissance spirit. When the financial markets collapsed on October 29, 1929, the Roaring Twenties sobered up and whimpered to a close. According to the Library of Congress, the unemployment rolls during the Great Depression swelled to 24% for white workers. Black workers sustained double that blow. In 1932, 50% of us were unemployed. These white folks are jumping out of windows, falling out like paper in the wind, my mother observed during that era. Bread lines and soup kitchens formed as Americans struggled for their next meals in a nation where a few short years earlier, surplus had abounded. My own parents and thousands of others relied on government assistance to close the gap between what they could earn and what they needed for basic survival. Over and over in our world, we have witnessed how today's riches can become tomorrow's scarcity. We do well to heed the lesson. In times of plenty, paucity sits by licking its lips and awaiting its next grand appearance. The Depression was just one of a series of devastations Black people endured during the 30s. In 1931, long before the innocent Central Park Five were deprived of justice, the Scottsboro Boys, nine Black teenagers, were falsely accused in Alabama of raping two white women on a train. In a case of blatant racial bias, an all-white jury convicted the boys and sentenced eight of them to death. The following year, the U.S. government sanctioned the Tuskegee Syphilis Experiment, a 40-year-long health assault on our community. Biomedical research doctors recruited impoverished Black men with the promise of free medical care. These physicians claimed to be treating the men for so-called bad blood, but in fact, they were using blacks as guinea pigs to study the long-term effects of syphilis. Scores of our men, knowingly left untreated with syphilis long after penicillin had been discovered as a cure, suffered blindness and death. The attack on our humanity continued in 1934. That year, the Federal Housing Administration established redlining, a set of racially discriminatory real estate and bank lending practices that barred blacks from purchasing homes in white neighborhoods, and thus set the stage for the wealth disparity between black and white households that remains to this day. Home and land ownership are the primary means by which Americans have historically amassed wealth. And when blacks were locked out of bank loans and segregated into slums, we were robbed of the potential to build fortunes. President Franklin D. Roosevelt's New Deal brought a measure of relief for poor blacks, but some of its policies, such as redlining, made the New Deal a raw one for us. It's no wonder that many African Americans carry a lingering distrust of whites, even those we sincerely love and embrace. Given the horrors of our abuse in this nation, we are understandably wary. To ever heal these deep racial traumas, and seldom has it felt more urgent that we do, we must acknowledge that they indeed still exist, throbbing and tender beneath the surface, spilling over like molten rage into the streets. As difficult as it is to recall this country's atrocities, it is essential that every American of every color does. It is critical that we connect that centuries-long, ugly history with in our times now, a cop's knee on George Floyd's neck, and bullets riddling Breonna Taylor's body. The line from our nation's original sin to its present heartache is not faint and dotted. It is solid and direct. And even when the impulse arises to cringe and look away from a system predicated on black oppression, a system that is still doing precisely what it was designed to do, we must stare into the face of our past and examine what happened here, on our soil, much of it less than a lifetime ago, a lot of it happening now. Turning a blind eye to our history has not saved us from its consequences. My early years played out during these two wildly different decades. The first, a cultural resurrection, and the next, a painful reckoning. In 1939, during the last days of the Depression, Billie Holiday stepped bravely up to a microphone at Cafe Society in New York's Greenwich Village and sang for the first time, Strange Fruit, a lyrical protest anthem. Southern trees bear a strange fruit, blood on the leaves and blood at the root. Black bodies swinging in the southern breeze, strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees. A bitter crop, battered and dropping, the bruised and blood-stained carcass of the other America. The nation's shifting times paralleled a spirit of change in our house. After my family fell apart, the basic rhythm of our existence returned, but it swayed to a more sorrowful tempo. Melancholy hung in the air, hovered over our soup bowls at dinner, settled into the cracks of our wood floor. When my mother and father weren't arguing, they didn't talk much. Dad was around a lot, often stopping by our apartment two or three afternoons a week. When he was there, he and Mom looked past one another, mostly remaining cordial and always maintaining an emotional distance. Much as I wished my family had remained intact, I was relieved to have the late-night battles in our rearview mirror. Alongside our gloom lived an uneasy peace for which we'd all paid dearly. Mom thought Dad would eventually move in with the other woman, He didn't. The two continued their relationship for several months after my parents split, but they ultimately ended things. It perplexes me that given the freedom to do as he pleased, my father chose not to be with that woman. I've often wondered whether she regretted her affair with my father, given that in the end, he did not stay with her. Perhaps Dad never truly wanted to build a new life with someone, but rather craved pursuing the forbidden. Mom did not file for divorce. In that era, West Indians weren't too into the whole divorce business. Some would live separately for 50 years and still say, my husband this and my wife that. For one thing, many couldn't afford the legal fees. And in my mother's case, all she'd wanted was to get her children out of the way of a man who'd suddenly gone berserk. But years later, when I was in my teens, my Aunt Zora, Dad's sister, said to me, the day your mother opens her bank vault is the day she'll get a big surprise. Following their split, my parents continued to share a safe deposit box. My aunt had reason to believe that my father had assembled divorce papers, and rather than having them served on my mother, he put them there for her to find. Mom heard the same story from my aunt, but didn't believe it. I have no idea whether my mom ever saw those papers, or if they even existed. My dad did marry another woman around 1940, but perhaps he did so illegally, without ever officially severing his first marital ties. After my parents parted ways, Mom took Dad to court for striking her. I was with my father one afternoon when he went to City Hall to review some papers Mom had submitted. Before we boarded the train, we stopped at a five and dime store. My eyes fell on a gorgeous cameo pin. Dad, noting my desire, said to me, do you want that pin? I nodded yes. He purchased it, in part because he relished delighting me, and probably also because he wanted to show the judge what a wonderful father he was. He fastened the pin on my collar as I beamed. On the way out, he bought me a ring with three faux rubies, one so popular then that practically every little white girl had one. As we walked up the stairs to the train, he took my hand and escorted me as if I were ascending the stairs to my castle. Later, in court, I glided in as the prima donna I felt like. Despite how much taller I'd grown, I was still my father's little string bean, his first girl. He constantly bought me small gifts, bracelets, trinkets, toys. When I'd return home and show Mom my bounty, she'd muster a half smile. Then later, if she got angry with me, she'd spew her resentment. This man who thinks so much of you. When I was going to the hospital to give birth to you, he had something else to do. And you're supposed to be his favorite? She often threw that one in my face. I realize now that Mom's rage had little to do with my dad's tenderness toward me and everything to do with how deeply he'd hurt her. Still, my mother's words blistered me as much as her beatings always had. Once Dad left, she didn't whip us as frequently, mostly because she didn't have the energy. After all of her many work shifts, she'd lumber through our door too exhausted to do much beyond prepare our dinner. My father contributed what money he could, but my mother bore the lion's share of the financial responsibility. Dad would often complain about how gnarly his fingertips had become from painting WPA war posters around town, another job he took on. Never once did Mom breathe a complaint about her duties. With sealed lips and persevering hands, she just got up every day and did what she had to do. The year my parents separated is the year my brother, then 11, began running away from home. Mom often said that Melrose, like me, was born restless, led by a spirit that called to him. He'd sometimes be gone for days at a time, long enough to frighten the hair off my mother's head. She'd walk the streets searching for her firstborn, her heartstring. She'd find him sitting out on a bench, staring off as if something in the distance had captured his attention. "Where you been all this time?" my mother would ask him as she led him home. He'd shrug and continue gazing. "And what did you eat?" she'd prod. He once mentioned that a kind man in our neighborhood would often spot him outdoors and then return to hand him a cup of milk. For years into his adulthood, Melrose wouldn't touch milk, probably because he associated it with those distressing times. He was a troubled child, my brother. We each had our way of handling the misery of our situation, and Melrose drifted out into the streets even as he drew inward. Emily dealt with our new reality by blaming my mother. My sister, though seldom one to withhold her opinions, said little to me then about our family's tearful transition. But years later, when we were grown, she revealed that she'd mostly held our mother accountable. She and Melrose had slept through much of the conflict I'd witnessed. What Emily did see had been enough to unnerve her, and yet, however poisonous our family dynamic was, she still desperately wanted our father there with us, at the center of it. She faulted my mother for walking away, not understanding that my father had long since made an emotional departure. In retrospect, I understand Emily's assessment not as an indictment of my mother, but as a way to cope with her own anguish. When your heart has been sliced wide open, you tend to haphazardly hurl rocks in every direction. You want someone, anyone, to ache and bleed as badly as you have. You cast stones and aspersions, the way we children once did at the other woman. After my mother left my father, we moved to a different church. Mom wanted a fresh start, away from the public disgrace. She couldn't stand the idea of my father's infidelity following her through the pews of St. John's, as her fellow parishioners traded whispers and knowing glances. My mother called Ms. Weeks, a dear friend she'd grown up with. "What church do you attend in Harlem?" she asked her. Ms. Weeks welcomed us to join her congregation, St. Andrew's Episcopal. In practice, Reverend Byron would still serve as our spiritual shepherd, as the friend and reverend Mom could call upon if any of us so much as sneezed. But our new church became St. Andrew's, then still a small parish, but now one that stands as a stunning neo-Gothic sanctuary near 127th Street and 5th Avenue. Though the congregation was predominantly West Indian, the minister, whose name I cannot recall, was white. The Episcopal Diocese of New York had appointed him to that parish, and the church is now a city landmark. As we settled into our second church home, we were just as involved as we'd been at the first one. Mom attempted to groom Emily as a pianist, hoping she might one day play in church. She also wanted to imbue all of us with some culture, as well as keep our minds and hands productively occupied. After purchasing beds for us, the next thing Mom bought was a ramshackle upright piano, which we scooted against a wall in our living room. Mom bought it from a black lady from the neighborhood, Mrs. Wilson, who gave Emily lessons at 25 cents per session. But Emily didn't take to the keyboard. "I want to play the violin," she told my mother, backing up to evade the dotted I she knew was coming. "When you get old enough to go to work and can buy a violin," my mother retorted, "then you can get one yourself." Since my brother had no interest in the piano, he would pick up any items he could find and turn them into drumsticks. I tell you, if my mother hadn't steered him away from what she thought was too worldly of an artistic passion, Melrose might have been a great drummer. I was the last remaining potential pianist in the house. After Emily quit within weeks of her first lesson, I began my lessons with Mrs. Wilson when I was 10. At 12, I could play every hymn in our church hymnal. At 15, I was accompanying both our congregation and the choir. I had such a knack for it that I also taught myself how to play the organ. The piano provided me with the consolation I needed to at last give up my thumb. One day when I was around 12, I stuck it in my mouth, pulled it out again, and stared at it for the longest time. "Wait a minute," I thought. "What happened to you? You don't taste so good anymore." From then on, the piano served the purpose that my thumb always had. It became my solace. During long afternoons as the sun's mango rays painted shadows on our walls, I'd sit hunched over those chipped keys, soothing myself with the message of the hymn that has become my daily meditation. "Just as I am, without one plea, but that thy blood was shed for me, and that thou bidst me come to thee. O Lamb of God, I come, I come." In a home and family uprooted, that song became my safe haven, my grace note. There, in the measures of that musical prayer, I find comfort still. 6. Unspoken. Parents lie to their children. They misrepresent their painful truths and their personal histories. Concealing is the human way of pretending that we are who we imagine ourselves to be in the fairy tales we invent, that our lives have unfolded as we wish they would have, rather than as they so wrenchingly did. My mother's falsehoods were not outright fabrications, but lies of omission. She spoke little and withheld much, a restraint every bit as damaging as a barefaced falsehood. Her silence cost us both. My first menstrual period arrived the same way most things did in the Tyson household, without much mention. It also arrived quite early, when I was just 9 years old. In those years, Mom had her way of keeping us entertained when school and the sun were both out. On summer weekends, she'd often take us on the L from our place on the east side all the way down to Battery Park. I lived for those rides. I'd poke my head out the train window to watch the world whiz by, savoring the breeze on my cheeks, gazing into the high-rise windows, and wondering about the families I spotted. Parks, museums, zoos. Mom shuttled us all over the city and the tri-state area. One Sunday afternoon, the four of us even enjoyed an annual boat excursion organized by our church out at Keensburg Beach in New Jersey. Early the next morning, Mom awakened me. "Go to the bathroom and wipe yourself," she said. I sleepily rubbed my eyes as she held up a square cotton rag and two long strings, each with a large safety pin attached to its end. "Put this on," she said. "Where?" I asked. She motioned for me to tie the strings around my waist and pin them onto the rag. Moments later in the bathroom, when I stared down at my scarlet-soaked underpants, I was sure I was dying. I don't know how Mom even knew I'd started my period. She'd probably dreamed about it or sensed it. I'd once overheard my sister mention something about menstruation and bleeding, and though I was older than Emily and should have known more than she, I wasn't at all clear what was involved. Nowadays, I cringe and shake my head in disbelief when I recall just how ill-informed I was. Maybe this is it, I thought, as I wrestled with the strings and positioned the rag between my thighs. When I emerged from the bathroom, walking like a zombie, Mom was standing there with her uniform on and her pocketbook in hand, ready for work. "Stay away from the boys," she told me. "I will talk to you when I come back." She hasn't gotten back to me yet. In the following months, when my flow kept returning for a curtain call, I eventually figured out the whole period business on my own. A few years later, my breasts joined the puberty party. The budding chest I'd had at 9 was in full bloom by my 12th birthday. That year, Mom had moved us from our place on 98th to 178 East 101st Street into a two-bedroom railroad apartment near my school, Margaret Knox Junior High. One afternoon when I was playing in front of our building, procrastinating on practicing the piano, I saw my father approaching from down the street. I sprinted up a hill to meet him, and as I ran, my boobs bounced downward and upward, jiggling and screaming for support. After Dad and I embraced, he turned to me with a serious expression and said, "Go upstairs and tell your mom to put a bra on you." I stared at him, and then down at my sandals, mortified that Dad had noticed that my boobs needed harnessing. I didn't mention his observation to Mom, but he must have said something to her because soon after, she arrived home from Alexander's holding an acknowledgement of my adolescence. "Put this on," is all she said as she handed me a white B-cup corset. I don't know why my mother hadn't purchased a bra for me before then, or whether she'd planned to talk to me about this mysterious corridor I'd entered. My guess is she was too embarrassed to speak about it. Also, discussing my changing body would have meant reckoning with the inevitable. Her firstborn girl, the once sickly child she'd for so long kept close, had grown out of her arms and into a new season. We did not talk about periods or breasts. We did not talk about sex. We did not, in fact, talk about much of anything regarding adolescence. The little I knew I learned from Emily or from my friends. That left me struggling to cobble together the truth, the whole time running for the hills whenever a boy came near me. What will happen if he touches me? Why did Mom tell me to steer clear? I got one clue from Fanny Lou, a neighbor a few years older than me. One afternoon, when a pregnant woman walked past us, Fanny Lou nodded toward her and then looked back at me. "You know where babies come from, don't you?" she asked. I nodded, not prepared to admit my ignorance. "Well, a baby is going to come out of that woman's stomach from where you go pee-pee," she said. I gazed at her in horror, trying to make sense of what she'd revealed. "A baby is coming out from between that lady's legs?" I said to myself. "But how did the baby get in there?" No clue, and no mother willing to sit me down and explain. Dating came late in our house, and it's a miracle it arrived at all. My mother was wary of strangers. Only family could be trusted, she reasoned. "If anything ever happens to me," she'd often say in the years after she and my father split, "I know I can rely on those two men to look after my children." The men she referenced were a couple of my father's cousins whom he'd grown up with in Nevis. I was around 14 when my mother discovered her faith had been grievously misplaced. One evening when brimstone spilled over between Mom and me about God knows what, I blurted out a secret I'd been too fearful up to then to expose. One of those men had put his hands on me when I was 11. During a moment when Mom had turned her attention toward supper, he'd brushed his palm along the backside of my dress, robbing me of a sense of safety, just as that white man on the street once had. Upon hearing my revelation, Mom hadn't yet picked up her jaw before Emily exclaimed, "And me too!" Until then, I hadn't known my sister had been touched. As outgoing as Emily was, she and I shared remarkably little about our interior worlds in those years, adopting the same code of silence our mother lived by. Mom's eyes filled with horror and she disappeared into her bedroom. She never mentioned our disclosure. I've often wondered whether she privately confronted that cousin, because after that day, we rarely saw him. From then on, she became so adamant about protecting us that she wouldn't even entertain male friends. She couldn't take the chance that another man would mess with her girls. Emily got an early start with the boys, long before Mom granted us official permission to court. My sister might have been a year and a half younger than me, but when it came to awareness, she stayed 5 paces ahead. From age 14 on, she was out there living her best life. I don't think she was having sex, but she had boyfriend after boyfriend. She'd meet them wherever she went. Down the sidewalk she'd waltz, with her Coke bottle curves and her beaming smile, drawing stares from young men. My mother, who was away a lot working, had no idea Emily was running around. Also, Mom was so busy worrying over me that she took her eye off Emily. "I went to see Miss Taylor this afternoon," my sister would fib, when Mom questioned her whereabouts. Or, "I went to the store with my friend Ruby," she'd claim. In actuality, she'd have her tail down at the park, carrying on with her newest heartthrob. I'm surprised word never got back to Mom. When Emily and I each turned 15, Mom at last allowed us to begin socializing with young men. She didn't refer to it as dating. She also didn't reconcile her previous insistence that I stay away from boys with her consent for me now to keep company with them. She had her reasons for loosening the reins. Her dream for Emily and me was that we'd meet and one day marry nice church boys, a desire made clear by her parameters. My mother's first commandment, "Thou shalt go out only with a young man who is the son of a minister." All other socializing had to be with family members she'd vetted. The Dorez family and their 4 teenage boys, cousins on my mother's side of the family, were on the approved list. So were our other cousins who were around our age, the Tysons and the Swanstons, all of whom were brilliant musicians. Schubert Swanston, the eldest of 4, was a piano prodigy who eventually worked with Louis Armstrong. He and his siblings played at least 2 instruments each, from the cello and the violin to the bass fiddle and the organ. After dinner on Sunday evenings, our family would gather for a concert at the Swanstons' place near us on the east side. Church, school, cousins. That was our protected world. Emily's parallel universe, invisible to Mom, was twice the circumference of my own. Horace Chenery was my first crush. He was a year older than me and as tall as heaven with kind eyes. He lived a few doors down from us on the same street and attended my school. Horace didn't go to church, strikes 1, 2, and 3 in Mom's book. But Horace's mom, Miss Violet, was an usher in our congregation. Violet's mom, Miss Lawrence, was half white and half black, and she'd passed her honey complexion on to her grandchildren. Though Miss Violet was my color, Horace was quite fair, with a dreamy smile and dimples. On the day when Horace and I caught each other's eye in our neighborhood, I blushed and quickly looked away. It wasn't just Horace's appearance that gave me goose pimples. As we got to know one another on long walks home from school, I felt drawn to him because of how he made me see myself, through the soft light of his adoring lens. "You know," he'd often tell me as we walked home from school,